You're listening to an ESA podcast brought to you by the Ecological Society of America. ESA, promoting the science of ecology.
This is Field Talk. I'm Liza Lester. I'm talking with the ecologist of land use and global change, Earl Ellis, professor at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and a founder of the Anthrams Project that breaks down the basic ecological categories of the world from the perspective of human use. Earl talks about global change, invasive species, and the benefits and dangers of valuing aspects of our natural world in terms of the services they provide us. And he talks about how what we think we know about ecology might be skewed by the individual but often convergent choices ecologists make about where to do their field work. Earl helped out Laura Martin, a graduate student in Bernd Blossi's group at Cornell University, in assessing where the ecologists are when they are in the field. In the context of geography, proximity to human settlement, climate, biome, wildness, protection status, and a host of other features. Laura looked through 5 years of high-profile ecological journals to tabulate locations of ecological field sites. And the trend she saw might surprise you. They report their work in the May 2012 issue of Frontiers in Ecology and the Environment. Here's Earl Ellis.
We expected to see a wild bias. There's at least a kind of a classic ethos. I think it's largely fading, but there was a classic feeling in ecology that you weren't really doing important basic ecology if you were doing it in an area where there were people disturbing it. You wanted to find some kind of pristine place to work. That's how you could really understand natural processes in ecology. So we expected to see that in the studies, that there'd be all these studies in places without any evidence of people being there or land use, and that would be the bias. In fact, we found the opposite. Actually, the places that could truly still be considered wild as having no direct populations or use of land in those areas are understudied, actually. And much more overstudied are, for example, urban forests are highly studied. Not to say there's anything wrong with that necessarily, but those forests are often taken to represent the processes in areas that are far less disturbed, for example. So really having a clearer grounding of where the ecology is done, that needs to be much more part of, I think, ecological practice. I should start by saying that actually this is Laura Martin's paper, and she came to me after she had already done a huge amount of work. Basically, she took 8,000 articles and looked for them to winnow them down to those articles in the top 10 journals in ecological sciences, you know, ranked by ISI over the past 5 years. She took all these papers and she went through them with some students helping her to find all the papers that had field studies in ecology. And as we know, ecology, at least terrestrial ecology, observations directly in the field are kind of the gold standard for how we understand ecology. That left her with, I believe, 1,800 studies.
Yeah, and she looked at all of these personally.
They looked at everyone and tried to figure out where the studies were done using the descriptions in the paper. And this, of course, varies between quite high-quality descriptions by some researchers who are using GPS and this sort of thing, to very vague descriptions that she really had to work very hard to come up with a firm idea on the ground. And I think she ended up eliminating a pretty substantial number because she really couldn't figure out where they did their work, which kind of says a lot about how seriously a lot of ecologists take the notion of geographic context for their work. And then so within that set of studies, she had already looked at how the authors were describing the context for their work, like were they working in a protected area or a forest. And then she came to me looking at, you know, whether we could use the location information that she had collected to investigate the global coverage of these studies in terms of the biomes, forests, grasslands, etc. And then also the anthrams, which is a concept that looks at the human context for ecology. So what are the globally important ecosystems that we manage, like rangelands, croplands, urban areas, and this sort of thing. So we looked at both of these categories. We also looked at areas in terms of population density. We looked in terms of biodiversity and potential primary productivity. We looked at all these elements to see whether or not the ecology that people were doing in the field reflects the actual current state of the terrestrial biosphere. I think there's a really simple message that came out, which is that the ecology, at least published in these elite journals, is wealthy areas, protected areas, and temperate zone areas are highly, highly studied. Whereas areas that are not protected, areas that are not in the wealthy parts of the world and outside of the temperate zone tend to be much less well studied. So you could argue that the ecology that we have in our textbooks, the basic ecology that we have, is based on a very biased view of what ecosystems are like. I think you can see that with a lot of the natural sciences that have a field component, but it's definitely present here. And so I think we did the first quantitative assessment of this kind of bias.
Tell me a little bit about why that would be a problem for ecological theories or developing paradigms. How is that bias going to compromise ecology?
Well, right now there's a great interest in ecology becoming relevant to managing and understanding global change. And a classic example of that is we have this discussion of a mass extinction. We also have a discussion of a massive invasions that are occurring, species entering new ecosystems as a result of human activity. We also have a discussion of rapid climate change shifting habitat, and therefore essentially the ranges of natives are shifting as we change climate. These are all global phenomena. For science to inform about the ecology and ecological understanding of these processes, you really need to have global observations. You need to be looking just as well at the tropical areas as you are at the temperate zones. And considering that most of the world is not wealthy and is not protected, to make ecology really a relevant science for informing global change efforts, whether it's protection or prevention or whatever, we need a more global science. And I can give some very specific examples. With invasion, it's a very obvious thing. We have a very, very poor understanding of invasion outside of the temperate zone. There's almost no studies, very, very few studies. We have no idea really how much invasion there is going on in the tropics, for example. It's kind of unknown. I mean, maybe it isn't a problem there. Maybe it is. It's one of these things we just don't have any real good data on.
Is that also a lack of natural history knowledge about those areas that would tell you what are even invasive things are?
Yeah. Or is this just... Well, that's always been a challenge, right, to determine the provenance of species, especially in areas in the temperate zone, for example, where, you know, human occupation is so long and so intense that, you know, really figuring out what's new and what was there from the beginning is hard to determine. And, you know, in the temperate zone, you also have 10,000 years ago, a lot of it was covered with ice. So everything's a novel species, a new species to some of these areas. If you look in the geological record, they're constantly moving back and forth. So there's no, like, classic distribution. Another thing that is really important is when you're looking at, say, a forest. So you're doing forest ecology. There's a tendency for researchers to describe their work as just that. We're studying the ecology of forests. Well, as we know, right, forests are really different, whether they're primary or secondary, the stages of succession, the degree of invasion, the degree of all sorts of factors, like the size of a forest really will determine a lot of characteristics about its ecology. That context is just missing from most of these studies.
You noticed this because you found that there was some difference between the self-reporting of the paper of the type of ecosystem they're working in and the way the GPS was mapping to your Anthrome database. So could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that would be an example. So you look at where the context is described. Sometimes it's GPS, sometimes it's a park or some other geographic information is provided, so you know where the studies were actually done. You look at that context globally, and you can see that, you know, all around this protected forest is either urban areas or farmlands, and that's not mentioned in the study. So that would be an example of, in a sense, not a bias in where the site is chosen, but a bias in the way the work is described.
So how does the Anthrome kind of model differ from the biome model when you're looking at your databases?
Well, in some ways, and I think this is important, they're very similar concepts. The concept of a biome is a globally significant ecological pattern, right? That's really the basic idea. And it's the first level of recognizing different patterns in the biosphere underneath biosphere. So it's a very strong simplification of the diversity of biological patterns that you're going to see. That's what makes it useful. It's just a simplified look at the large global patterns of biology, basically, on Earth. The Anthrome concept is very similar, except that it says, instead of just the classic view that the reason that we have different biological patterns in different parts of the world is basically caused by differences in climate, like wet and warm areas, our tropical forests, and this sort of thing, it looks at the context that humans bring to the land. And a simple example of that is, you know, why aren't there forests growing in the cities? Well, there's a city there. Maybe there's some forest, but that forest is different. So it brings that human context at the global level. So it's also kind of a simplification of the global patterns of biology, but it's one that includes people. So it's a much more realistic view. I think you can see almost anywhere, like for example, grasslands are mostly missing in most of the world because they've been converted into croplands. So we recognize them as croplands with perhaps some grasslands embedded within them, rather than looking at grasslands with perhaps some humans disturbing it. Because in many of these areas, in fact, 3/4 of the world, a human effect is going to predominate the kind of the natural pattern. You're going to see a very strong human effect in most of the terrestrial biosphere now.
So even if you have a big grassland that has a pretty low population, you have pastoralists coming through there and they're having a strong effect on those areas.
Yes.
And that kind of thing.
Yeah, you can't really understand the ecology of these places without people.
To return a little bit to the question of the wild bias, why do you think that is? Is that because people go into ecology and they want to study wilderness and that has that kind of idealized, untouched
there's
world?
Part of it, I think, is an attempt to idealize nature. I think that is part of it. And I don't think that's unusual to ecologists. This is all through a lot of, especially in the developed nations where you have people that don't spend much time outside, or they just do it in, you know, in backyards and this sort of thing. They're not working with nature all the time like farmer kids are. Mm-hmm. So they're not as used to the idea that, you know, well, actually a lot of nature is, you know, kind of managed. It's a kind of idealization, get back to nature kind of thing. But I think that it's also a reasonable scientific approach at one level, right? If you're trying to understand a process that is not complicated by humans, you know, you got to find a place that isn't managed by people in some way, because we do have a profound effect. There is a certain sense that, you know, other different disciplines like forestry, natural resources management, agronomy, these other disciplines deal with the managed ecosystem, and therefore the duty of ecologists is to deal with those that aren't managed. But in practical reality, most of what ecologists do these days is manage forests and preserves and this sort of thing. And so it's a self-defeating thing to some degree now. And I think that things have changed a lot. I've been going to Ecology Society meetings, you know, U.S. ones, for more than, 17 years or something like that now. And the change is incredible. I mean, it used to be that you would definitely feel like the odd one to talk about something like I used to study as my predominant area, which would be village landscapes in China, ancient agricultural landscapes. That really, it's almost impossible to conceive of them as having a natural state other than villages. For ecology conferences in the U.S. in, you know, 1993 or something like that, that was odd. That was just weird, weird, weird. And now I think people are thinking, hey, you know, this is kind of cutting edge. This is where we need to be going. You know, this study kind of points the way to that to some degree. It shows this understudying of those kinds of places. That was not what I really expected to come out of this, but it definitely shows up in the data pretty well.
Speaking of conferences, you were a speaker at our recent conference in February at Emerging Issues, and this conference was looking at developing ecologically based conservation targets under global change. So you were part of the symposium on managing ecosystem services. And I remember that during the panel discussion that followed that symposium, you kind of expressed a concern that if we focus too much on these ecosystem services as a solution to human problems, that we'll find maybe a technological fix that could fix the same problem, and then the ecosystem will be kind of cast aside or will no longer see the need for that. Could you talk about that a little bit in this context of thinking about applied things and maybe the fears of scientists who are worried about moving more towards this anthropogenic view of, or mixed anthro-nature?
Uh-huh. Well, you know, there's several different elements to that point. And what you're referring to most directly right there isn't necessarily a part of the paper with Laura, and it's not necessarily a part of the concept of anthropes. Because, you know, what's amazing is that I expected a lot more pushback from conservationists and kind of classically trained ecologists about the concept of anthropes, but I haven't had that. It's really not been the dominant theme. Most people are pretty aware, most scientists who work in the ground are pretty aware that humans have modified just about all the ecosystems and that that's relevant. And needs to be thought of. And so there's actually been a pretty strong embrace of the idea. Not necessarily that they think that's good, and it's not necessarily for good or bad, but it's something that has to be considered. It's important. Now, but the ecosystem services idea is interesting. Now, ecosystem services have been around now for a while, and it did begin with the idea that you could value nature in dollar amounts in terms of the services provided to humanity. And the classic example might be, you know, water purification or pollination or something like that. And at first that sounded all good. Really, to me, I had no criticism of it. I thought, hey, that's a really smart way of engaging society to consider more strongly the value of natural systems. It was just adding something that was missing from the equation, right? There was no real way to value that. And so this brought that into the equation. So clearly, if we're valuing that, then we're going to value it more. But here is something that's evolved in my thinking, and I think a lot of others too. I'm not you know, the only person who's thought about this at all. When you put a dollar value on something like water purification by wetlands, say, then you bring up the idea that, well, if there's a dollar value attached, then let's go to the marketplace. Because that's what we do with our valuing things in dollars, right? We go to the marketplace. And how is nature going to compete against engineered solutions to water purification? I bet you anything, there's almost no natural process that can compete against an engineered process when it comes to the marketplace. You know, I can build you a better way to produce food than hunting and gathering in a forest. We did that. We're doing that with just about everything, water purification, all these kinds of things. Substitution of a technology for a natural service is usually a much more effective capitalist approach to providing services. The value of nature is not about its ability to provide us with services. In fact, one of the fascinating things about humans in the Anthropocene, in my opinion, is that we've gone beyond that. We actually don't need nature for food. If we want pollination, we bring in the bees. If we want, you know, grain, we grow it. We don't necessarily assume that nature is going to provide everything for us. And in fact, I would say we're way too big for nature now. Nature can't really provide for us. And therefore, it's our responsibility to do that. And as we do that, we value nature more because of what it does that we can't do. We can do domestication, but can we do evolution? Can you make a tiger? Can you make a redwood forest? I mean, it's impossible to do. That's just something that we have to value for itself. It has values that I don't think anyone would dispute. I think we all can agree that these are wonderful things that we don't want to lose and we will support. And we have to do it in that grounds, not just because we need them to produce some kind of service for us. Maybe the service is just that they exist, just that they stay with us on this planet. So that was what I was getting at with that. That the value of nature is really beyond any kind of economic value. The place where I see it still being very valuable, though, and I've seen this many times, what if you already value the wetland, right? You already want to keep the wetland. Then you can bring in this idea that, well, if we already want to keep the wetland, we can show that it's not just sitting there doing nothing.
So it kind of mitigates the cost that you see economically.
Exactly. And I've seen that already
not as big
with
a
like
cost.
Carbon programs that or help with a existing stream restoration program where you want to plant trees. It just adds some economic values that help you do something you already wanted to do anyway. But I think that from first principles, the idea that you're just going to value nature because of its economic value and services is not a good strategy overall. But I think, you know, when it's used in a context where it's just adding value to an existing program, where's the loss there? It just helps educate people about how valuable this thing is.
To kind of wrap up here, I wanted to ask you a little bit about your history as an ecologist and what kind of took you into ecology. So you have this background in rural China, and it sounds like that's actually more unusual than I would have thought in field studies. How do you think that kind of shaped your worldview to be working
there?
Well,
I have a kind of unusual background in general. I have a PhD in plant biology, and my work originally was based on looking at carbon transport within plants. And I did my PhD research in the basement of a building, feeding radioactive carbon into a system that, you know, measured carbon exchange within plants and all this. I had gotten into this because I wanted to do something really beneficial for the world. And I thought, you know, farming and crop productivity were the most valuable thing I could do. Crop physiology, I got into that to improve crop yields. And then I realized very quickly that actually crop yields were not necessarily related to the productivity of plants, but more to a farming system approach. And that was at the time, this was in the late 80s, when sustainable agriculture became a very interesting subject for a lot of people. I felt like that was the way to go. So I got into sustainable agriculture, which then led to an interest in working in China, where I thought for the first time we could actually do some ecological studies of what makes an agricultural system sustainable over the long term. And so that's what I set out to do, and I looked at nitrogen cycling. But very quickly I learned that a lot of that traditional systems had been transformed by heavy use of industrial technologies, you know, to make them much more productive, and that this was not only a big local change, it was a big global change. So I got interested in global change and global ecology. So it kind of started off with an interest kind of just in, you know, managing agriculture more sustainably, which I felt was an ecological thing you had to understand, to kind of a landscape approach to ecology, because that was one thing I learned from the farmers there, is that they really did manage the landscape. They didn't manage just a field. They put things together. And then global ecology and global change kind of emerged out of that.
I come from molecular biology, so I also come from the lab side. And when I thought of ecologists, I would think of people that really wanted to work outside in exotic locations. And so I was a little bit surprised by the degree of the bias you guys found in this paper. And I'm wondering how much of that is not chosen, but is just kind of a constraint of budgets and teaching requirements and where people have to be in order to do their job.
Yeah, it's a great question. I don't think we can answer that directly. We didn't succeed in this, but I think we were attempting to look at the locations where the investigators were housed and contrast this with the locations of their research sites. And that would be a useful thing to extend the analysis. I think there is definitely something there. The places that you can study the best are the places you can spend the most time in. And that is obviously going to be a place closer to where you live. And remember, these are English language elite journals. That's going to be a bias right there. If we went to, in a sense, a random study of ecological publications, which would, of course, be almost impossible to do, we might see a very different makeup of the study sites. This elite research has a larger impact on the science of ecology. So in some ways, it's the responsibility of these elite researchers to make their work a little bit more global than it tends to be. But that's going to require a change in funding paradigms, too. Like, where should ecology be done?
And who should be doing it?
Yeah, exactly.
Can we bring in people in these other places?
Exactly. So, and that is part of the paper. It's the recommendations that we make based on what we've observed do reflect that idea. There's a tendency, like, to look at the more productive places and to avoid the least productive places. That we did our study purely on area base. So, for example, if tropical rainforests cover, you know, 20% of the world's land, we would expect 20% of the world's studies to be there. But you could also argue from an ecological point of view that, well, you know, the most important thing is just not how much area, but how many species.
Complexity.
Or how much primary productivity, you know, how much total biomass is in these places. And in that case, you know, it shifts the way you look at the world. It shifts the way you would choose to do your studies. There is a more complicated, more nuanced effort that would need to go on to really produce a map for where we need to study more, which I think would be a useful effort. And I think maybe we may even do something like that at some point.
Well, Earl, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Take care. Have a good one.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Ecological Society of America. Music was provided by Dr. Nicholas Catelli. For a link to Dr. Catelli's homepage, more information about ESA, or additional podcasts, please visit www.esa.org. Thanks for listening.